This program is a production of KUNM in Albuquerque. Back in the 1920s and 30s, Gallup, New Mexico was one of the major coal mining areas in the United States. The owners of coal mines had great influence over local and state officials, and there was also a great deal of labor organizing. When coal miners went on strike, the governor declared martial law. In the spring of 1935, Gallup was the scene of a riot that resulted in the murder of a local sheriff and a famous trial that tried to assign blame for the killing. Now a Gallup native has written a book that tells these stories. Gary Stewart is the author of The Gallup 14. He was interviewed by Marcos Martinez.
This is quite a history lesson, and I'm sure that a lot of people, even native New Mexicans, are probably not aware of this really fascinating story. Now, this is set in the early 30s in New Mexico, 1933-35, and it has to do with a riot and some murders that took place. Gallup at the time was a coal mining town, and there was quite a bit of, I guess you could say, labor unrest.
I guess you could call it that.
The way you tell the story, there was a lot of backroom dealing going on at the time. There was a lot of stuff happening that maybe was somewhat unsavory. Would you say that was pretty typical for that time for New Mexico?
I think it was typical. I think, unfortunately, it was the rule, not the exception. The reality of this story is what struck me as amazing when I first got onto the story, because there was an enormous coal strike, a miner's strike, in 1917, and the largest coal mining company in New Mexico, and by definition, therefore, one of the largest in the country, because the coal fields in Gallup, New Mexico, were the third or fourth largest coal-producing region in America in the 30s. And the 20s, and certainly some of the teens. But this large strike in 1917, in order to break the strike, the mining company went into Mexico and brought into New Mexico hundreds and hundreds of workers for the purpose of breaking the strike. And they put them in an area that ultimately became known as Chihuahua in Gallup. And those coal miners and their families lived there from 1917 up through and including 1934 and early 1935. By then, these men and their families, the men worked in the mines, actually many of the children worked in the mines too. But they had developed this community as a part of Gallup. But it was a part that was focused almost entirely on mining families. In an effort to break the strike of 1934, the reverse happened. Instead of bringing men and their families into Chihuahua, the coal company sold the land. They sold it to a state senator, Senator Vogel. He evicted some of the people and announced plans to evict the rest. And it was that underpinning, that ferment, that terror, that feeling of loss of control when you not only don't have a job, now you don't have a house. And it was the combination of those two things that created this environment that resulted in the riot in the alley behind my grandmother's house. The story was so important to me because as a little kid, I played hide-and-seek in that alley. The telephone pole where the sheriff of Gallup, Sheriff Carmichael, was hit up against as the two bullets hit him, one in his head, one in his shoulders. I hid behind that pole as a little kid. I know it like I know things, like everybody knows things that you remember from childhood. So when I found the story, I thought, my goodness, this has to be my story and my town's story. And that's what happened.
You have a really interesting way of telling the story. You tell it in the first person, and you tell it, I guess you could say, as someone who is born and raised in Gallup, as someone who has intimate knowledge and awareness of the place, the lay of the land, and that sort of thing. Why did you choose to write the book that way?
The first-person narrative is a rewrite. The original book, the first rewrite, not the rewrite, the first write, was actually a hokey idea that I had that fortunately a lot of people talked me out of. Gallup told the story. Gallup was a talking town, and it, there's no such thing as it, but it told the story. I was quite thrilled with that version, but good editors, good professional writers, people with far more experience than I have, or certainly had at that time, said, you know, it's an interesting idea, but you need to find a different way to write this story. So I still wanted to tell it in a first-person sense. I wanted to narrate the story, and I invented this fictitious lawyer, Billy Wade, because I thought I could tell the story better from my own legal perspective if I had a lawyer telling the story than I could if I had a physician or an engineer, since I'm neither of those. So that's why I elected that form to tell it.
The story is certainly populated by these really interesting characters. One of the main characters, I guess, is this deputy sheriff called Bobcat.
Bobcat, yes.
How are you able to, in the research that you did, to get at the personalities of these people and the sort of nuance that makes them people that you're able to sort of bring to life?
Because the connection between the Wilson family and the Stewart family is an old and abiding connection. When Bobcat died in 1989, I think it was, my dad was a pallbearer at Bobcat's funeral. My mother worked for the Gallup Police Department for a while as a radio dispatcher, and she talked to Bobcat over the radio on a regular basis. All the teenagers in Gallup when I was growing up, we all knew Bobcat. We tried to stay out of his way because he was a good sheriff, but a man that if you were a teenager, maybe with a six-pack of beer in the back seat, you weren't looking for Bobcat. And so we tried to avoid him. Bobcat's son, Larry Wilson, was a good friend of mine in high school. He was 2 years behind me. And Larry helped me a great deal by talking to me about his dad and telling me things about his dad that only a son can know. So I had and there were other people, but Larry was particularly intrigued and helpful about telling me about his dad. So I was able to paint a picture of Bobcat, who's a genuine hero, that I think comes through in the story.
Now, some of the other people who weren't exactly heroes included some elected officials and people like owners of the coal mines and so on. How did you feel about presenting some of these public figures in a less than favorable light?
Well, it was not only difficult, it was personally troubling. No one likes to say anything unkind or unflattering about someone else, at least no one I know. I take no pleasure in doing that. But the story about some of the characters in the book who did some things that they might not have been proud of then or now.
Like declaring martial law in McKinley County, for instance.
Yes. All of that comes through loud and clear in both the legal documents and in the newspaper coverage at the time. One of the things that struck me as so moving, so emotional for me, was to read the governor of New Mexico sending a telegram to the governor of Colorado on the very day that this riot happened. And the telegram asks the governor of Colorado for his help in arranging mass deportations of illegal aliens, all without a sense in a legal environment that the people who might be subject to deportation did in fact participate in this riot. That became such an enormous problem. Another thing that struck me, I spent 3 days in the library of the Supreme Court in Santa Fe, actually copying page by page the trial transcript, which was sent to Santa Fe on appeal. Actually cost me 10 cents a page. I remember plugging dimes in that machine for days on end. But in reading that transcript, there was one of the most moving parts of this story came out, because I had a great deal of trouble understanding how hundreds of people could be gathered up, rounded up was the term that was used in both the press and in the legal documents, how that could come about. How is it that guilt by association is a reality in the New Mexico that I love, in the Gallup that I loved and grew up in? I really couldn't understand it. And then I read the trial testimony under oath of Agustin Cavallo. And John Sims, one of New Mexico's very, very best and most famous lawyers, John Sims asked Mr. Cavallo on the witness stand, tell the jury, what happened when you were arrested? And he told the story. But he used a phrase, Mr. Cavallo did. He said, they pointed at me and said, and also you. And I went back and read it again. Surely there's more to it than that. Turns out there wasn't. And also you is the story of what happened here. I came very close to calling this novel And Also You, because it says everything that needs to be said about what happened. Mr. Cavallo had no role to play in this riot. He didn't do anything. One witness out of the 28 witnesses on the witness stand identified Mr. Cavallo as having been present at the scene, and he described him as having been present by saying he was a large man with a heavy mustache who had a club in his hand, and he's running very rapidly at a high rate of speed. He's really moving. He's trucking down that alley with this club. 3 days later, Agustin Cavallo takes the stand, and he gets up from the bench that he'd been sitting on for 9 days, and he cannot walk. He has never been able to jog, much less run. His condition was like that from a child. He had an operation as a child in Mexico. And then he explained what happened in his arrest. A deputy pointed at him and said, and also you. And that's how he got there. And his involvement was as simple and limited as that. Notwithstanding that, Mr. Cavallo spent 3 months in the state penitentiary in Santa Fe and watched that jury leave the jury room and go out and determine his fate and decide whether or not he was going to be executed in the electric chair for capital murder. I get a little worked up about this story because it is a powerful and moving story. And, of course, it involves lots of people other and in addition to Mr. Cavallo. But those two incidents told me that this is a story that, while relatively well known by scholars, lots of people on this campus here, for example, knew this story very well. But they knew tidbits. They knew pieces here and there and here and there. When the manuscript was initially reviewed by scholars here, one of the things they liked about the book was the extent of the research, because they thought that from an academic standpoint, that would support the telling of this story. I still find it hard to understand, even in context, how this could happen. And then, the more research I did, and the more I read, and the more people that I talked to, I did come to an understanding. Sheriff Carmichael was a much respected and much loved man of the law. He didn't deserve to die in that alley that day. He didn't do anything to create the environment or the problem that resulted in his death. His death was indeed a tragedy. And somebody in that crowd shot him, killed him, and probably shot him given the trajectory of the bullet. I actually had an engineer draw out the trajectories for me, so the likelihood of him being murdered was very high. It wasn't an accidental bullet, wasn't a ricochet. He was shot, and somebody was aiming at him when he was shot. The real issue was, who did that? And should everybody suffer because what one person, or perhaps two, did?
All of the research that went into this work, notwithstanding, are there parts of the story that will always be a mystery?
Oh, yes. Yeah. One of the larger mysteries here is who in that crowd fired the gun that killed Sheriff Carmichael? Who in that crowd fired the gun that lodged a bullet in Bobcat Wilson's shoulder and nearly killed him. He had very little chance of living, but he did. I've actually read the medical reports and the surgery reports on Bobcat, so I know how serious and invasive that wound was. So that's still a mystery today. Another mystery that I spent an enormous amount of time and had absolutely no luck. I tried to find Navarro. Navarro was the man at the center of this. He's the man that Matt Carmichael had an arm around as they walked down that alley that morning. And when the smoke drifted away and the sound returned to normal and the dust settled and the blood had been spilled, Navarro was gone. He's nowhere to be seen. And you would think, given his fairly long role in Gallup, that Navarro would have surfaced at some point, somebody would know about him, but there's absolutely no evidence anywhere of what happened to Navarro. So I'll probably spend a good part of the rest of my life trying to find an answer to those two problems. Who shot Matt Carmichael, and what happened to Navarro?
Would you like to read a passage?
Yes, and let me preface it by saying that the trial transcript itself contains the words under oath out of the mouth of the witness. But the question in the trial transcript was posed, of course, by one of the lawyers during the course of the trial. I am a trial lawyer at heart. That's what I do. I decided it as one of the pieces of literary license that I would take in this is that I would adjust or change or modify the question asked by the lawyer, but I would leave the answer intact. The way it came in is the way it came in. So I think that part of the testimony in the book that was intriguing to lots of people is the testimony of the very ordinary people that testified in this case, not the sheriff's deputies or the police officers or the business people, but the people who happened by pure circumstance to be there. One of those was a very young girl whose name was Inez. She was 14 years old at the time. And she testified in this case. I'll find a little piece of her testimony for you. Her testimony, I thought, was very moving. I don't honestly know exactly what Inez looked like. There were some descriptions, but they were not strong. So I had a mental picture of what she probably looked like from those descriptions, and that's how I described her. And she certainly did make a stir in the courtroom. But this is part of her testimony. David Chavez was the prosecutor. He turned to Inez. The jury was fixated on her, but she seemed to be troubled by some or all of the defendants sitting on the long bench to her left. She looked over there several times as though she were looking for someone she knew. The first question from the district attorney made her uneasiness clear. "Now, Inez, you see the defendant Leandro Velarde there on the bench, don't you?" She said yes in a voice that was distinct but very small. It was as much a whisper as it was an answer. "I'm sorry, you'll have to speak up a little so the jury can hear what you have to say. You did say yes, didn't you? You do know Mr. Velarde?" "Yes, I do know him," she said, only marginally louder. "When did you last see him? Before today, I mean." "It was the day of the shootings. That's when I saw him. Then they took him to Santa Fe." "Mr. Velarde lived near you, that is, near your parents' house in Chihuahua, is that so?" "Yes, our house is across the street from theirs. His wife lives there, and so did he and his brother, before he died." "How long had you known Mr. Velarde and his brother?" "For 5 years, or maybe even more, at least 5 years." "How did you come to see him on the day of the shootings?" "Was it before or after the shootings?" "It was just after, I think. I was there when he came home. Everyone was crying because of Ignacio. That's why we're all there. His wife was crying, and so was I." "Now, we've talked about this in my office, but as I told you, you have to tell these men on the jury what you saw. What you saw at the Velarde house that morning. When the defendant, Leonardo Velarde, came into the house that morning, and you were there, What did you see? I saw him take an ice pick out of his dress and put it in the icebox. Do you know what time it was when you first saw him that morning? That is, when you saw him take the ice pick out of his shirt. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning when he came home. I was at his house because his wife was crying, and I went to see why she was crying. I saw him take an ice pick out of his dress and put it in the icebox. You say dress. He wasn't wearing a dress, was he? He took it from his pants, the bib of his overall. He put it in the ice chest. Was he putting ice in the ice chest? I don't remember if he had any ice. Did he seem upset? Was he hurt or anything like that? I don't remember if he was bleeding. I don't remember if he was limping. You said that before. Before he got there, his wife was crying. Did she tell you why? Before Leandro got there, she knew that her brother-in-law had been killed because she came ahead. What do you mean she came ahead? She came ahead. She was there at the place where Ignacio was killed. She saw it, and she was crying because of the killing. That part of the story was important to me because all of the anger and the anguish and the grief was largely about Sheriff Carmichael. He was not the only person killed there that day. There were three men, two killed right there, dead at the scene, as they say. One died the next day. There were seven other people wounded, some of whom were treated, some of whom had massive wounds, like Deputy Bogus and Deputy Wilson, Bobcat Wilson. But others had serious gunshot wounds. A young woman was shot in the leg, in the back of her leg, as she was running out of the alley. But no one really knows who did that. But the newspaper coverage and the sentiment in the town from personal interviews that I got from people who were there, close by at least, no one focused on what happened to the other people that died or were shot, other than the deputies. And an appropriate focus should have been placed on Deputy Carmichael and the deputies, but it struck me as unkind that there was so little said about the other people that were killed. Part of it was the sense that the other two men that were killed must have been shooters, must have been active shooters in this. The testimony about them was that at least one of them did, in fact, have a gun in his hand, because there were a lot of guns in that alley. But not all of them were found. The most famous one was not found. And no one knows where that gun is. That's a third mystery. It would be fascinating to me, and I think other scholars and historians, to find out what happened to that gun.
You say that this event, this incident, changed Gallup forever. In what ways is that change still evident?
Well, the Gallup that I lived in as a child, as a teenager, was a town that was a real community. I played my one of my best friends as a young child was Billy Martinez. Billy lives in Albuquerque now. Billy lived in Chihuahua. I didn't know it was Chihuahua. I mean, I knew that was the name of the part of town, but it didn't mean anything. It had no political or social significance of any kind. And the playhood, the playground games between those who talked Spanish, at least on the playground, English in the classroom, the gringos like me, the Irishers like me, there was no hostility, no competitiveness, no sense that you were somehow different. I left Gallup in 1957 and joined the Air Force and moved away, and my first duty station was in New York, and I thought I was on another planet. Because there was a very strong sense of ethnic difference, and I didn't have that in Gallup, at least I didn't see it. Maybe it was there and I was blind to it. I'm blind to a lot of things, I suppose, but I didn't see it there. So that's why the story was so important to me. But what happened in Gallup was that there was a time, a very brief time, a tragic time in which people, because of the language they spoke, the color of their skin, the place that they worked, were put into cattle cars and shipped to the state penitentiary on the flimsiest of all possible evidence. The test by which you either got in that cattle car or you didn't was whether somebody else thought that you might or were in fact in the alley. Not what you did in the alley, but you were physically present. If you were physically present, you went to the hearing. That's how it worked. By the 50s, I think a lot of that had changed. And a lot of it had changed because, as Erna Ferguson put it in her famous book called Murder and Mystery in New Mexico, she had a chapter about this story. And it was a documentary. It didn't purport to be a novel. But she entitled her chapter, New Mexico Tries Its Own. And that's what happened here. New Mexico did try its own. And it found those men innocent of capital murder. All of them. All that were charged were found innocent. And that was an important thing. The first letter from a lawyer that was highly regarded, a respected, skilled lawyer, but easily classified as a radical lawyer, A.L. Warren, was a Los Angeles lawyer. He wrote a letter to Governor Tingley the day after this riot. And he posed the question to our governor, will Gallup become the next Gastonia? Will it be another Scottsboro? Because it sure looked like it. It was all there. All the makings were there. But that's not what happened. New Mexico tried its own, found its own innocent, as it should have done, and the rest is history. So that's why it was a watershed legal and social event, I believe.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Gary Stewart is the author of The Gallup 14, published by the University of New Mexico Press. The book has a website at www.thegallup14.com. This program was produced by Marcos Martinez with help from Steve Hodelitz for KUNM in Albuquerque. Thanks for listening.